You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Oh, look, it's Derek Davison and Danny Besner of the American Prestige Podcast, and I'm Robert Wright of the Non-Zero Podcast, so this must mean that it's another high synergy episode of the collaborative American Prestige Non-Zero Podcast, which happens every couple of months or so, notwithstanding
these really should be national holidays.
They should.
People should consider them. Given the time to consider them.
There's talk on Capitol Hill about that, but I don't want to say anything too soon.
No, I mean, fair enough.
So we've only done three of these, and they're only every 2 months. And yet, the very first one involved discussion of Gaza. And that means, I guess, that this war is heading into its fifth month right about now, right?
Yeah, wild. Yeah,
that
terrible.
Would be correct.
Whoa.
yeah, whoa.
So I guess the levity portion of our podcast is ended. It's starting.
Was that premature?
Should we go ahead? No, let's return to levity. Go ahead.
Let's have a little more banter.
This is not levity. This is related to that because you've done much more than most people have like talked to people from quote unquote both sides. So I was just wondering, like, what is your assessment of both sides' arguments? You know, you've talked to Israeli liberals. You've talked to, you know, people on the other side of a fight that, you know, one might not seem to have another side. So I was just wondering if you had any conclusions or anything interesting to have drawn from that.
Yeah, I just actually aired something with Russ Roberts, who's well known for his Econ Talk podcast, but is also president of a small college in Jerusalem now. He's been living in Israel a few years. You know, sadly, in general, when I look at things like this, I find that people on both sides are behaving the way human beings behave. I've long said that Israel, as unwise as I think so much of its policy is in terms of its own long-term security, even they act no more crazily than we acted after 9/11. When you look at their situation, certainly when you look at October 7th, I mean, you know, if you look at how crazy we were after, you know, launched God knows how many wars in response to 3,000 people dying, and you correct for everything, like the size of Israel, how threatened it feels, rightly or wrongly, and so on, it's kind of proportional to what we did after 9/11 in a certain sense. I mean, as grim as that sounds, I do have a lot of times of just wondering why almost no one in Israel seems to be saying, folks, we may be, you know, making things much worse for ourselves in the long run, making more of the world hate us, creating a new generation of terrorists, and so on.
But, I mean, I think they just think they're going to cleanse the region and take it over, and that the world will forget, as the world has forgotten many things many times. It's not to me that wild a position. You know, it seems to be like this is what the Gush Emunim and the Likud, the right wing of the Likud, which is now just right wing, have wanted for decades at this point. So that seems pretty legible to me, and they think the world already hates Jews and the world's going to continue to hate Jews.
That is, I think, a big factor is the feeling in Israel that whether you think of it as hatred of Jews or hatred of Israel or hatred of Zionism, that it's like this universal constant, can't get worse, nothing they do will make it worse. I mean, at the same time, people say there is a rise in anti-Semitic acts around the world in response to what they're doing in Gaza. And I guess the way they'd parse that is to say, well, that's just latent anti-Semitism being expressed. I'd still say bigotry in general is better latent than expressed. So if you're doing things that are increasing the amount of expression, that's one reason to reconsider it. But I've long thought that this was an important ingredient of Israel's policy, the idea that they're going to hate us no matter what we do. So we have to act as tough as we think is necessary.
The idea that you're just going to cleanse. I mean, I agree, Danny, you're right. But that's the provenance of the Israeli right. What's interesting to me is what's left of the Israeli left or even left of center that seems to be just in denial about who is running the country. Like, you just had an event a few days ago where over a dozen cabinet ministers, and not just from the fringe parties, from Likud, which is the mainstream conservative party, attending an event calling for the ethnic cleansing and reoccupation, resettlement of Gaza. And the reaction to this from people, at least on social media, which is, you know, the only place that I guess I encounter any reaction, is, well, these guys are just on the fringe. They're in the cabinet. They're running the country. Like, how does that work? How do you imagine that they're just fringe figures who can be dismissed? And I don't know, Bob, if you've had those conversations with people and what the response is.
I haven't asked that exact question. I think it's a little bit like us and Trump. Like, when Trump is president, you want to say to the world, well, this isn't like really, this is just Trump. He'll be gone and then we'll be back to the real America. But of course, he came to power through an electoral process, and he is, in fact, America, so long as he's in office. And you got to live with that fact. He reflects something real that's going on in America. But, you know, you always would rather, if you view the person, whether it's Trump or Bibi, with utter disdain and contempt, you'd rather think they're not characteristic of your polity. But they kind of are. I mean, Bibi's been in power for most of two decades.
Yeah, I mean, he's the central figure of Israeli politics in this century so far. And yeah, he's moved in that time to save his own skin further and further right. But he's been comfortable doing that. And it's worked. The political calculation that if I embrace these, you know, ever more fringe right parties, it will enable me to retain power because that's where the electorate is going, has been correct. I mean, he's held on to power all this time.
No, and it's gotten more and more extreme in terms of who's in his cabinet. That's a trend.
Literally convicted terrorists at this point are in the cabinet. I mean,
blows me away is that the guy had a portrait of Baruch Goldstein on his wall until a couple of years ago. He decided if he was going to get into politics, that was probably a bad look. A guy who slaughtered dozens of Palestinians in a mosque with a submachine gun. Yeah. Danny, I agree on the ethnic cleansing thing. It does seem to me that that's the only way to think of this as a really coherent policy. What they're doing now is if they envision the culmination as ethnic cleansing, there's no other obviously happy ending. I mean, from their point of view, I mean, obviously ethnic cleansing is not a happy ending, but I mean, from Israel's strategic point of view, and I'm not even sure ethnic cleansing makes the world a great place for them. That's another question. And I don't know how many people are thinking about this. I think a lot of people in Israel are not really thinking clearly about the outcome. They're still thinking we're going to eliminate Hamas somehow, I guess.
I mean, is that what Israeli liberals you talk to say? Like, that's absurd. It's not even worth talking at that point. Like, you're not in the same reality. Then you're not living in reality. If that is your claim, then what are you even doing?
But I think if they did something like, and this could happen any moment through some big intelligence breakthrough, I guess, if they killed like Sinwar, the political leader of Hamas in Gaza, and or killed the military leader, Mohammed Daif, or whatever his name is, you know, Bibi, of course, Bibi doesn't want the war to end, so Bibi might not do this, but he could plausibly say at that point, okay, you feel satisfied, and probably enough of the Israeli people would say yes, you know? This was
that's not the
top of Hamas, and we eliminated.
But that's so obviously not the... I mean, this is like the culmination of a 50-year or 100-year project, depending on how far you want to go. You know, this is why these conversations always seem so wild to me.
Well,
it's not like a secret, you know? This is what's always so funny. People are very clear about the intentions. They want greater Israel, some of which includes to the east of the Jordan, you know, to the east of the West Bank, even. I mean, they say that. To Israel, there are people like building menorahs for the third temple. It's not exactly a secret, which is why some of these conversations just always feel so strange. It's like they're in a reality that's not operative and hasn't been for a long time.
I don't think the sentiment that sentiment is characteristic of most Israelis. But I think most Israelis, if Gaza could, from their point of view, suddenly become not a security problem, they'd be like, whatever, we don't have to occupy it.
But that's fantasy land. That's not real. That's not a real.
Well, that's another question. I just mean, I think the quest for to populate all of historic Palestine is per se not necessarily a mainstream thing in Israel. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, there is a couple of things are happening now that I guess could bring this to an end. One is apparently the Biden administration is dispatching Bill Burns. That's still the idea, right? To talk about, and you know,
he's been there. He was there. He was in Paris earlier this week talking.
Okay, earlier this week, but the conversation is ongoing, right? They supposedly are making a significant push for a long ceasefire that they hope could lead to an actual negotiated end of the war. Listen, I've got a news flash. This blew my mind when I read this. This is from NBC News. There's been a major insight that has dawned in the White House, apparently, about things superpowers can do. Listen to this. Dateline Washington. The Biden administration is discussing using weaponry sales to Israel as leverage, okay? Hadn't occurred to me. If you're giving them all the weapons, you might have some leverage. So anyway, these people in the White House is way ahead of me.
They're
way ahead of me.
Yeah.
This is stunning.
Wow.
To convince the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to heed longstanding U.S. calls to scale back its military assault in the Gaza Strip, according to three current U.S. officials and one former U.S. official. I don't know if this is an intentional leak, and maybe this is the first tentative step toward actually doing this. It's kind of advertising to Israel that they might, but it's something, I guess.
Do you think it's a leak for Israel, or is it a leak for the domestic?
Well, it could well be that. It's so weird that the administration seems to think that we'll be impressed if they say, well, we asked Bibi politely and he said no, so we're really trying. No, that doesn't make you look good. That makes you look like a wimp, you know? I mean, but they do that a lot, right? That's their line.
The new line is they're heartbroken. I saw this now. This is like every spokesperson for the administration this week has been at pains to talk about how Biden is heartbroken by what's happening in Gaza. And that word, that specific word, is what they seem to be using. So, yeah, we've gone from like just kind of callously questioning whether the death toll, the casualty count was even accurate to, oh, you know, we're really trying to talk to these guys and tell the Israelis to kind of tone things down. But they're just, you know, it's an ongoing conversation with our partner here. And now we've gone from that to, you know, every other day, it seems like there's another story in Axios or some other, you know, access journalism outlet about how frustrated Biden is with Netanyahu. And that's, you know, we've added now the heartbreak to that. And I think it's all for domestic consumption, really.
Well, I don't think it's going to work. I mean, what do you think about the way this plays out in the election? I mean, the standard critique is like, you know, Biden is using these decades old reflexes about appeasing the Israel lobby. Of course, there is also this line that he just has this heartfelt special thing about Israel. Could be. He certainly likes to think of himself as someone with empathy. And I think that was triggered on October 7th. But anyway, one theory is like he's paying attention to forces that are real and important in American politics for sure, but he just doesn't quite understand that, you know, when you run for election, you need all these young, enthusiastic volunteers for one thing, and you may not get them this time around because of his Gaza policy, not to mention the concerted effort in some swing states by Arab Americans to come up with, I think, maybe some kind of alternative candidate even.
Yeah, I think, I think the reflexes, the political reflexes there, not just from Biden, from the entire, you know, gerontocratic leadership of the Democratic Party to support Israel, but it appeals to voters who have already decided they're not going to vote for Joe Biden. I mean, I think that any inroads that he could make would be for people who aren't going to vote for him for a variety of other reasons.
And in the meantime, he's losing young people, losing Arab American voters, which could be key. I think also it just kind of this message that they're delivering now after, you know, coming to it, 4 months into the war, of helplessness, basically, of like, we're trying, we're talking, and we're really frustrated, but there's nothing we can do. Yeah, I think it plays into this image of Biden as basically incompetent, which feeds he's too old for the job. And there's a whole like story that's developed around that that I don't think helps him politically.
So, Danny, were your friends going to vote for Biden in the first place?
Were my friends going to vote for Biden in the first place? Are you talking about the lefty, the dirtbag left?
The younger than me left.
I mean, probably if they voted, right? They weren't going to vote for RFK. They probably weren't going to invite Bernie Sanders. I don't think they would have made an electoral difference. And most of them live in the coastal elite cities anyway. I mean, it's just like he's so obviously decrepit, and it's strange that people don't talk about it. It's just weird. It's like everyone knows it. It's very weird, and it just shows the weakness of the party that they don't have anyone else. The parties right now are both like very weak.
Where are the Dean Phillips heads?
Where are the Dean Phillips heads?
That guy's a Democratic version of Ramaswamy. And in case you're wondering about his views on Israel, William Ackman donated $1 million to his super PAC. So I'm guessing he was vetted on that issue. He's a thoroughgoing hawk. I mean, he wants to sound creative and interesting enough to say the occasional non-hawkish thing, but his instincts are like, you know, we should have fought Russia over Ukraine in 2014, that kind of thing.
But over Crimea. But Bob, what do you, I mean, like, what's interesting to me about this moment is like the lack of almost political interest among the young. It's just like the nihilism, you know, is more than anything. Like, there's just no sense that things are going to get better for people under 40. Mm-hmm. And there's no belief, like no one's listening to any of the promises. No one believes that Biden's going to cancel student debt. No one believes that they're going to stop these large asset management firms from buying huge amounts of property, et cetera, et cetera. It just seems like everything's fucked and people have accepted that. It feels like what the late 70s probably felt like. But the context is very different from the late 1970s. I just think things are going to get worse.
Now, the late 70s weren't like, I mean, young people today are hopeless in a way that people weren't in the late 70s. The late 70s, you were entering a period of just kind of disinterest, relative disinterest.
Well, you could buy
on college
a home.
Campuses.
You could have a family. You know, like these are things that are out of reach of many people who are like college graduates, you know, like quote unquote successful people. And that's pretty new in modern American history. I think in post 45 American history, there's been periods like that before, but not in the modern era.
No. And I mean, one thing about the current crisis is it has given young people something to rally around and in a more organized way than I've seen. I mean, just thinking about my daughters, you know, and their lefty friends, you know, there's something in the air. I don't know where exactly it's going to lead. I wish that somehow, you know, rather than Dean Phillips or in addition to Dean Phillips, we somehow had some somewhat better known establishment Democratic figure who's at least a little to the left of Biden on this issue, like a Tim Kaine or somebody, right? Who would be taken seriously. I mean, I think anybody remotely like Tim Kaine would beat Biden in an actual, you know, nominating contest. First of all, but the kind of pressure he'd put on this issue would lead to kind of a healthy, maybe some healthy debate.
I mean, that's the thing. I think they just don't feel, I mean, maybe they're starting to get wise to it because he's getting protested at every event, which also, you know, is not particularly conducive to political success. But I think they still don't really feel the pressure coming from people who want a ceasefire and are concerned about what's happening.
And they're not imagining the pressure on the other side. I think, Danny, you're right. It's not about voters. These days, the most ardently pro-Israel voters are in the Republican Party, the evangelicals. But there's a whole infrastructure associated with the Democratic Party of donors and institutions that will slap you on the wrist if you say the wrong thing about Israel, like the Anti-Defamation League, and these think tanks that will be quoted in the, you know, like Foundation for Defense of Democracies, it'll get quoted in the New York Times saying you didn't retaliate hard enough against Iran or whatever, and and you deserted the, you know, there is a real thing there that he's not hallucinating about. It's just that, and I honestly don't know which is stronger. I think he's kind of screwed. I don't think there's some kind of obvious solution to his political problem. Now, I think somebody like Tim Kaine could finesse it. And look, it wouldn't be hard to introduce a pro-peace message right now in discourse with Biden without being dismissed as a crank and saying, use our leverage, let's get it done, you know. But anyway, wasn't meant to be. There's no, all of the, everyone this side of Marianne Williams, and I don't even know what her views are, or even if her last name is Williams or Williamson, but
well, we're her foreign policy team, Bob, so tread
you
carefully.
Are you
okay?
So is she reliably left? Maybe I'll vote for her. But
she is an artifact of the 70s new age in California more than mm-hmm. anything, right? I mean, no, here's what I find interesting, gentlemen. I think we are actually returning to a pre-World War II moment where the spectrum of right and left really doesn't make sense. Like, it really doesn't make sense for most of American history. You know, you have the progressives, you have the populists. The progressives have a left-wing element, they have a right-wing element, the populists similarly. You have these different constellations of power that don't really relate to left and right wing, which are very much formed in the 19th century in Europe. And so I think this is a lot of our political vocabulary is atavistic, isn't actually really situated to understand what's going on. So I think one thing that's been frustrating to me is I think a lot of the political discussion has been really weak recently. I think if you compared what's been the type of conversations that are happening now to what was happening in the, you know, let's say 1950s to 1990s, it's much worse because the language of left-right made more sense when there were self-consciously a conservative movement and a liberal movement, both of which, by the way, are really artifacts of the 1940s and not before. So I think there's like a lot of problems with just how we even talk about politics. Like Marianne Williamson, to describe her as left is not even really correct. It's like a totally different constellation from which she emerges. And the same is true, I think, for a lot of the new politics that are emerging right now.
Also, I mean, how many people are there on this thing that you will eventually hope to call the left, I guess, if it coalesces?
I mean, like, America, like, never had very powerful labor unions, right? So, like, this is the problem with the American left, mm-hmm. is that throughout its history, it wasn't like the European left, where there was, like, you know, a social democratic party with its own institutions. Mm-hmm. So the American left, due to the various peculiarities of American politics, is like scattered. So that question is almost, it's not even answerable. Again, mm-hmm. also the left doesn't really make sense in the American context because we have these two gigantic parties that basically serve as a constellation, a weak coming together of interest groups. And the Republican Party is going nuts right now because the, you know, the three-tiered elements of fusionism are obviously coming apart. So no one knows what that's going to be. And the Democratic Party has basically turned into a corporately financed party of what you might say are like center left liberal elites, which don't really have an organic base in any real movement. Meanwhile, unions are kind of all over the place because they're run by these like boomers and older Gen X people who emerge from a very different political context that doesn't relate to today. So we don't even have like a good understanding to say like what even is a left in America. It doesn't make sense.
You know, before I say something about that, I should make a public service announcement. At some point, the public part of this podcast will come to an end. You'll hear some voiceover or something. We don't know when it's going to be. We leave these decisions to our highly paid media strategists. But at that point, anyone who's a paid subscriber to either the American Prestige or the Non-Zero newsletter will be able to hear the whole thing. They may not even notice it happening because they may have already set up their special podcast feed that includes all the bonus podcast content, not to mention any bonus written content. So that's my, I assume I have your full support on that.
Of course.
Of course. And people should know we still have the discounts going. So if you're subscribed one, you can get a discount for subscribing to the other.
Oh yeah. And Bob, you know, we're partially at The Nation now, right? Our free episodes, most of them go up at The Nation.
Oh really?
Yeah,
so you're
yeah.
doing real media synergy. Pretty soon, you're not even going to be returning my emails.
We're at the epicenter.
Straight to trash.
I'm going to turn on MSNBC, and it's going to be like, oh, shit, no wonder they didn't return my emails. Yeah, they've replaced
Chris Hayes. Yeah.
But hey, he's feeling his oats on this issue.
What has he been saying on this issue? I haven't been paying attention.
Oh, there have been some memorable rants. I mean, I had some Twitter exchanges with him on Ukraine where we had a stark disagreement. I was too radical for him. But no, on this issue, look, I mean, it's interesting the contrast between the two, right? Like Ukraine and this, it's like there's a lot of people who either weren't questioning. And look, they're complicated and they're very different. But I feel a lot less alone on this, which leads me, I mean, I wasn't against arming Ukraine. I just had a bunch of questions that the asking
I was against
got
it.
Me in trouble. Yeah.
And everything I predicted came true. What are people just going to say? Listen
oh,
to
man.
Bessner.
Listen
to Bessner. He's always right.
We should have a contest. 14 months ago, I had a piece in the Washington Post saying, you know, to some extent, echoing Mark Milley saying, look, now is the time to cut a deal. Things aren't going to get better on the battlefield. Just Ukrainians are going to die. We're going to waste money. Exactly what has happened. I rest my case. So with all due respect for your own impressions, Danny.
Nostradamus is over here.
But anyway, on the left thing, look, I applaud your devotion to the left, and I hope something meaningful coalesces. It already has. I mean, you're seeing this energy in the streets. That's great. But I don't think the salvation of American foreign policy can wait for like a true left majority in America. That just takes too long. And I think you have to somehow get a message of sanity out, you know, of what like a sane foreign policy would be out to.
So this is where my Marxism comes in. I think that's an ideological project that could depends on persuading people. And I don't think that's going to have any effect in the long term. I think you actually have to attack the sinews of the empire itself. Right. You actually just have to be very, very specific about closing bases. You have to be very, very specific about reducing the budget. Everyone in D.C., the blob is not going to change. They're so ideologically bought into the project that they literally can't change. Like their appetizer orders in Alexandria depend on them basically buying into something. So you need to form some sort of very directed political coalition that is very, very conscious about attacking the needle points of empire, the sort of hinge points, not needle points, the hinge points of the empire. Otherwise, nothing's going to change. No minds are going to change. That is not the key, in my opinion, to salvation. And if I was taking off my political hat and putting on my analyst hat, that's not going to happen. I think the machine of empire is basically running on autopilot at this point. I think that's what the last 20 years have demonstrated.
So, Derek, do you are you with Danny? You're like we can't see your hands. You're making Molotov cocktails even as we speak.
Yeah, I'm in my militant bunker doing the work. Now, I mean, I have a hard time imagining that you're going to persuade anybody. And I don't know if it's because I've given up on persuasion, period, or if it's because I just don't think there's any way to persuade the leadership of a political party whose opinions about the world all calcified like 20, 30 years ago. And this is, you know, again, I feel like I've probably spent too much time talking about the gerontocracy, but like, what are you going to say to Nancy Pelosi or Joe Biden or, you know, any of their acolytes, even somebody a bit younger, like Anthony Blinken, who came through this kind of, you know, brainwashing apparatus and whose whole career has depended upon hewing to the beliefs that people like Biden formed in the 1980s, what are you going to say to them to convince them that the world doesn't work the way they think it works?
And just to two-finger Derek very quickly, I know, Bob, you like psychology. Like, I know one of the most robust, I mean, who knows what that means after the replication crisis, but a very robust finding in psychology is that political opinions actually get calcified relatively early in life. Like, I remember I was doing for my first book, I was, you know, a guy who came through the Weimar Republic and it really shaped his politics. And I was researching, if I recall correctly, the social psychology. And like by 30, it's like most of your political opinions are pretty in there. So it's very difficult psychologically, from what I understand, to persuade people.
Yeah, I mean, I do think a kind of point of entry is how completely distorted the narrative about American foreign policy and our actual history is. I mean, recent history. And like, I've gotten a number of, in my newsletter, a number of, you know, on our Friday kind of issue, a number of lead items out of just explaining to people what the truth is, how, you know, this idea that Hamas got control of Gaza by staging a coup after they won an election, which obviously makes no sense. If you win an election, you don't need to stage a coup. What really happened? Well, and then they find out what really happened is much more complicated. It involved Hamas saying, okay, we're fine with, you know, we'll talk two-state solution, you name it, blah, 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 and us saying that's not enough. And the history of the Houthis and everything, I mean, there are some people who just hadn't thought much about foreign policy. You're kind of blown away when they hear what the actual truth is.
At the public level, for sure. The public doesn't matter, though.
Yeah.
I mean, like, this is what my entire scholarly career is dedicated to studying, is why the public doesn't matter in foreign policy. And it's a trend going back about 100 years. And there's been like institutions and a lot of norms. It's mostly institutions created to make sure the public doesn't matter. It just doesn't. It does not affect foreign policy.
So what is your actual plan? Are you just resigned to hopelessness?
I don't have a plan. I mean, absolutely no disrespect at all meant, but this is like the question that the liberal always asks of the leftist, is like, how do we get to your utopian vision? And I think the problem is no one knows how. Ultimately what I really think is that it would be very difficult given the last century of history. I think that, and I could get into why, I might have talked about this with you before, but I think like after roughly World War I, it was very, very difficult to put the machine, to move the battleship in a different direction for a variety of reasons. You know, like if you're looking at this from a macro historical perspective, once workers fought each other in World War I, it was almost all over. Once the revolution happened in Russia, not a great situation for global communism or global socialism. So I think that we've been on a path-dependent journey for a while now. Not totally. There's always contingencies, but the contingencies didn't work out in the left's favor.
Hmm. You're getting me kind of bummed out here, man.
Truth. You know, it's just like, what a great historian once said to me, Martin Jay, great historian, actually a liberal who studied the left. He said to me, one person's pessimism is another person's realism.